The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm Director of Author Events here, and I'm very pleased to welcome our guest this evening. I've been reading Deborah's writings for well over a decade, and I assume you have as well. Perhaps like me, you were one of the many young adults dragged through museums by your parents, intent on expanding your horizons. Perhaps you were dragged to the Norman Rockwell Museum in Stockbridge, where for the first time you actually enjoyed and thought you understood the art on the walls. Rockwell's art has become, and I don't mean this unkindly, the wallpaper of our lives. Deceptively technical yet accessible paintings, including Rosie the Riveter, Freedom from Want, and The Problem We All Live With, lurk in the mind when we think of the story of our country. It's a story Deborah Solomon has been telling for many years as the creator of the Fearless Questions For column in the New York Times, and in her many articles as an art critic in various publications, as well as in her biographies of Jackson Pollock and Joseph Cornell. In a recent article, a reviewer at the Wall Street Journal urged readers, in anticipation of Thanksgiving, every American who cherishes the traditions that make this country great should acquire a copy of American Mirror, Deborah Solomon's brilliantly insightful chronicle of the life of illustrator Norman Rockwell. Miss Solomon's fine biography is a marvelous treat, the reviewer went on to say. Here to continue the story is Deborah Solomon.
Good evening, everybody. And Andy, thank you for that very gracious introduction. Much appreciated. It's so great being here in Philadelphia. I arrived this morning and managed today to go to both the Philadelphia Museum of Art and the Barnes Collection, even though it was closed, so that took a lot of muscling to get in. And I went to see the Maxfield Parish mural that is still hanging in the Curtis Building. And I've seen it before because, of course, the Curtis Building is a big part of my Norman Rockwell biography, and I just get such a tingle every time I go there because it plays such a large part in my book and in Rockwell's life. And I mean, his life was very much a Philadelphia story. You know, even though he moved from New York City, where he was born, to New Rochelle, where he started out as a young artist, then to Arlington, Vermont, and finally to Stockbridge, the town he is most associated with, he was in Philadelphia all the time. And it's just incredible to think that it is the one geographical constant in his life. When I go to the Curtis Building, I think of him running up those steps for the first time in 1916 as a young illustrator who wanted to sell his covers to the Saturday Evening Post, which, of course, was at the time the largest circulation magazine in America. And it was at the Post that he made his reputation. Of course, it's fair to say what was his reputation. He was beloved by the public as a result of his Saturday Evening Post covers, but also, as you all know, no doubt, criticized by the art establishment for many years during his lifetime, and kind of written off as a lowly calendar illustrator and a kind of culture polluter. And he became kind of the opposite. He was viewed as the opposite of what we view as the modern art movement. So I came to this project initially from a traditional art historical background. I studied art history at Cornell in the 70s. And we were taught that Jackson Pollock represented the apex of American art. And that's fine. I love Pollock's work. But I'm amazed. I've been amazed for many years as an art historian how much abstract painting has really overshadowed all the other good work that was done at the same time, much of it realist or figurative. And lately I've noticed that Edward Hopper seems to really be rising. His stature, I think, is rising every day, because every time I turn around, there's another Edward Hopper show in New York. There was just a great show of his drawings at the Whitney. And Hopper is as well regarded now as Jackson Pollock is in terms of being a master of American art. And I think as more attention is given to figurative painting, and once we kind of escape from the whole delusion, all the delusions of the modern art movement, that more attention will be focused generally on many artists who lived and worked in the shadow of abstraction. So I did one book on Jackson Pollock, and then I did another book on Joseph Cornell, the box maker. That was my last book. And when I started my Rockwell book, I really took the plunge into pop culture. I was not sure what I was getting into, and it turned out to be far more fascinating than I had anticipated. I really loved working on it. I haven't separated from the subject yet. Imagined what I will do after this. I was obsessed with the book for 12 years. And now it's done and I feel bereft. But Rockwell turned out to be a much more complicated figure than I ever could have anticipated. He, of course, called himself an illustrator, not an artist, and was an incredibly humble and modest man who did not pick fights or arguments and was genuinely tolerant and fair-minded. It's interesting that he painted the Four Freedoms. I'm sure all of you are familiar with the Four Freedoms, which is why I'm not showing slides. Let me go back a bit. Okay, so he started at the Post in 1916, and he survived there for many years, painting mostly scenes of boyhood, children and their dogs, a lot of mutts. And by World War II, he really wanted to do something great. He wanted to make a contribution to the war effort. He felt as if he hadn't really done too much in World War I. He had been very young at the time and hadn't done posters the way everybody in his neighborhood in New Rochelle had. So during World War II, of course, he painted the Four Freedoms, and which are at the Rockwell Museum in Stockbridge at the moment, except for one, actually. The Thanksgiving painting, Freedom from Want, which has that larger-than-life turkey in it, is now in Chicago, where there is a show on the history of food in art. Sounds interesting. I haven't seen it yet. But so Rockwell originally proposed the idea to the Office of War Information, and he was turned down by them. Because they said at the time that they really didn't want illustrators doing war posters. They were going to get real artists. And the government, one of my favorite disclosures in this book, is that the government, the Office of War Information, actually asked Marc Chagall, Salvador Dali, and Kuniyoshi, a Japanese artist who was living in America, to do recruitment posters. You know, I don't know what they were thinking. And none of those artists turned in their assignments. So Rockwell published his Four Freedoms. He went ahead and did them and really poured his heart into them. And I think they're so important. I'll tell you why in a second. And those were published in the Saturday Evening Post, not as covers, but as inside images. And the minute the government saw them, the U.S. government, the people in Washington, they realized they had made a terrible mistake, and they commissioned the works as posters and used them to help sell war bonds. In those days, Americans actually paid for their wars, unlike now, where we just, you know, assume someone else is paying for everything. We raised money for our wars, and so those posters were given away. You could get a set of reproductions of the Four Freedoms if you bought a war bond, and the price is stored at $18.75. And I think the posters are so important. I think everyone in Philadelphia is constantly asking the question, if you live here every day, you are thinking about, whether consciously or not, how do we visualize American values? You're probably thinking, I never thought about that. But I mean, here you are with the most symbolic imagery this country has to offer, like the Liberty Bell, Declaration of Independence, right? Which, how many, you have one copy, you have, what do you have in terms of the Declaration of Independence here? In Independence Hall, I assume? But there's a, right. Well, how many, I just said how many do they have? I mean, there's more than one version, so. One is coming on loan. You don't have one here permanently in Independence Hall?
It's a constitution, but I don't believe
it. Okay, got it. Well, okay, so you have a lot of parchment, let's say really historic parchment in this town. And that's kind of what kids think of, like when they study American history in school. You know, and patriotic imagery does often consist of documents and fabulous signatures. Curly signatures with lots of flourishes, or the Liberty Bell, or Uncle Sam, of course. He was kind of a staple image on recruiting posters, as you know, starting from World War I, when there was the famous painting poster, Uncle Sam Wants You, I Want You, for the U.S. Army. So every day, I'm trying to say, you see patriotic things around you. Buildings, sculptures, and maybe documents for those of you who go to look at the Constitution. And as I now know, not the Declaration of Independence, but Rockwell was able to visualize our values in a way that no one had ever thought of doing, because he wasn't, you know, painting documents and patriots necessarily who were well known. He was painting ordinary Americans. And in the Four Freedoms, he really allowed this country to understand what World War II was about. It wasn't about killing people. It was about preserving a way of life and the values that we stood for. And you all probably know freedom of speech, which is a tall Lincoln-esque man standing up at a town meeting. Freedom from fear, which is two parents looking in on their sleeping children. They're not putting their children to sleep, as has often been reported. They're looking in on children who are already asleep. Freedom to worship. And freedom from want, the turkey painting. And I think when people saw those paintings, and in the 40s, you would see those paintings everywhere because stores displayed them in the windows. They were in every bakery window and every butcher shop. And it really allowed Americans to believe that they were better than other people, that they were really caring people who made good decisions all the time. And it captured what they wanted to be, good parents, good neighbors, just really good people. So that was an incredible victory for the Saturday Evening Post. That was a high point, I would say, in its history. And I don't know if anyone here is a historian of the Post and how much it seems like a presence today in Philadelphia. Do we have any historians of the Post here? But I think that what's interesting is how little it's remembered outside of Philadelphia. Here you have the Curtis Building, so of course you're constantly reminded of it. But compared to other magazines, I feel like the Post has come to play a much smaller role in American history, because what it really is known for is Norman Rockwell, a creator Rockwell, and F. Scott Fitzgerald. It published his first stories from the 1920s. And the rest of it has kind of fallen away, which is fine. I mean, magazines are not necessarily great literature, and there's no reason why their articles and illustrations have to endure into the future. Eventually the Post was surpassed in circulation by Life magazine. This was during the Second World War. People wanted to look at photographs. Life magazine was new. and life would win the circulation wars, which, in addition to other factors, eventually led to the decline of the Saturday Evening Post. So I would say that Rockwell's Four Freedoms represented a high point in his personal life, but also in the Post's life as a magazine. What many people don't realize is that Rockwell was pushed out of the Saturday Evening Post, and I devote a chapter to that because it was so incredibly sad to me, and also because I work in magazines myself. I have for a long time, and you know, all writers who work in magazines love, you know, have a love-hate relationship with them, and the hate part comes because they're always catering to the youth demographic and always trying to appeal to people who they think have all the purchasing power. I never understand. Does it make sense when magazines appeal to America's youth that they're appealing to people with the most... Do kids spend more money than their parents? Does it make sense? No. So why is it so important to always win over people in their 20s who really may not have the best judgments of the world and what's interesting? But magazines tend to be obsessed with youth. This is well known. And in the early 60s, Rockwell was told not to paint any more genre scenes for the Post, that the magazine just wanted to have celebrities. They sent him to California to do Bob Hope and basically made him so miserable that he had no choice but to leave. You know, he could no longer do what he wanted to do. And what they offered him was something he wasn't interested in doing, meaning painting celebrity portraits. So he left. He had no contract with them. He didn't get a penny when he left the magazine. And he never complained about it in public. He was very much a turn-the-other-cheek kind of person. The Post, I don't know. Is there anybody here who loves the Saturday Evening Post still? But its legacy has not been looked at, I think, closely enough. It's what its role in culture was. Originally, do you all know it was a very conservative magazine? It was politically conservative. The editorials ran on page 22, and every week in the 30s, anyway, and 40s, denounced President Roosevelt, denounced the New Deal. Your parents hated it? Did I hear you say that? Got it. Your parents got it? They hated it. That's funny. Your parents, were they in Philadelphia? Yes, they were. Okay. It was politically conservative, but there were a lot of interesting writers writing for it who were not necessarily politically conservative. It was a little like the Wall Street Journal today, where it has a conservative editorial page, but that somehow... And an ultra-right, actually, editorial page that doesn't negate the quality of journalism and reporting in the rest of the newspaper. So the Post was constantly beating up on President Roosevelt, and that's another thing about it that's not very attractive today. I mean, it was kind of on the wrong side of history and accused Roosevelt of trying to bring socialism to the United States. After Rockwell left the Post, he fortunately, was basically recruited by Look magazine, where he was assigned to cover the civil rights movement. And that's why he was able to do the great painting, The Problem We All Live With, which is the defining image of the civil rights movement. There's nothing else like it. You all know the image. Ruby Bridges, a little black girl who's totally adorable, is shown walking into a school in New Orleans, desegregating it as four marshals surround her. And I love the painting. Rockwell kind of lopped off the heads of the marshals so that they don't have faces. Only this little black girl has a face, and he makes her both a symbol of all the injustice in the world, but also a real person, because you could see what she looks like. And it's really a very powerful painting. And I think it's incredible that he was able to define our most communitarian values during World War II, and then later on in the 60s to define the restlessness and disgust that led to the civil rights movement and made Americans realize that something has to be done, that there was going to be a war, basically, again, between the North and the South. But anyway, so to be here in Philadelphia for me is very moving because I just, you know, I wonder what kind of shadow the postcast today. I want to ask all of you that, but maybe not much of one. Maybe it's long gone. They left Philadelphia in the 60s. They moved to New York City, and then finally Curtis Publications moved to Indianapolis, where it is, where it now exists. And basically it exists just to license Rockwell Images. And there are always lawsuits about or arguments about this, like why do they have the right to license Rockwell Images? Were they buying his images for one-time use or to retain forever? Okay, so if somebody wants to, now I'm really, I'm just getting into the part of Curtis Publications that drives me nuts, but if I write an article, and I've written many about Norman Rockwell, and I want to reproduce one of his paintings with my articles, I have to buy it from Curtis Publications, and they charge a lot. So in 2010, I did a piece for the New York Times Arts and Leisure section, a big front of the section piece on Steven Spielberg and George Lucas's show in Washington, D.C. They're the leading collectors right now of Rockwell's work outside of the Rockwell Museum. They showed their collection in Washington. And I did a piece, and then I wanted to reproduce the paintings with my article that I discuss in the article, obviously. And the Times could not afford to reproduce them because the rates charged by Curtis were so high that they said, you know, we can't pay $1,000 per image to reproduce them. And it's interesting, you know, that Curtis still controls these images. And I think that's one reason, actually, that Rockwell's work is not more appreciated art historically today. You can't reproduce it. It's hard to get permission. It's very expensive. And it was funny because, you know, Sotheby's is auctioning off three paintings tomorrow, three very important Rockwell paintings tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, Sotheby's Auction House in New York. So have you guys read about that or not? Okay, all right. Now I'm going to back up a little. Ken Stewart used to be the art editor of the Saturday Evening Post. And like many editors at the Post, he helped himself to a lot of Rockwell paintings. They were so little value that editors would just take them, and that was fine with Rockwell. It never occurred to him that art collectors would want to put them in museums and they would sell for a lot of money. So Ken Stewart is no longer alive, but his three sons are selling their holdings tomorrow morning, and they're supposed to raise more than the sale is supposed to raise about $50 million. One of the paintings is Saying Grace, which is one of Rockwell's masterpieces. It's the grandmother and the little boy sitting in a railroad depot on Thanksgiving, giving thanks. And so where were we? Oh, Saturday Evening Post. Yeah, yeah. So the Saturday Evening Post still retains copyright. If you want to reproduce a Rockwell, if someone wants to reproduce... Oh, I know what I was going to tell you. I'm sorry, guys. Okay, so when I saw that Sotheby's was auctioning off those paintings, I thought, you know, they must have gotten permission. They have so much money. I'm sure they got permission to reproduce them and to distribute them to the press. And I thought, maybe I could use some of those illustrations with my articles. It is this much of a problem getting permission to reproduce them. So I called their press office and I said, okay, you must have cleared the rights on Saying Grace. Are you sending out press images of that? And they said, no, Curtis gave us only one-time permission. And every journalist who writes about those paintings has to call Curtis. That, you know, so when the Times did their big story, Carol Vogel wrote it on the auction that's coming up, the Times had to call Curtis and get permission and pay a lot to reproduce the pictures coming up for auction. And I think one reason that Rosie the Riveter in particular is not as well known as the other Rosie the Riveter, there's another one that has no copyright on it, and I see it on mugs. Have you ever noticed it's a woman in a bandana with her sleeve rolled up? And she's everywhere. Like, if you go, I see her on mugs all the time, and she's a great icon for the feminist movement. But Rockwell's Rosie, in the meantime, is not reproduced anywhere, because you know why. Because you'd have to pay Curtis a lot of money to reproduce it. I don't usually talk about this, but being here in Philadelphia, I'm just amazed at how much I feel they have really exploited Rockwell and his legacy over the years. And it really bothers me as somebody, as an art historian who is trying to have him elevated permanently into the pantheon of American art, which I try to do in my book. It's very frustrating to find that it's so difficult to reproduce his work. I don't know why they still have control. One reason they have control is that the Rockwell children, the three sons, are very nice. They don't like suing people. And so, you know, they don't want to get... It would be a lifetime pursuit, as you could imagine, if they were just going to sue everybody who had paintings of Rockwell's and claimed copyright and all of that. I mean, they just... They're artists themselves, and they have other things to do. Okay, let's see. We can't end on such a sour note. Rockwell, I didn't tell you anything about his personal life, so I should probably say that quickly. Did I hear somebody laugh? Someone's chuckling. Excellent. Glad one person finds me amusing. Okay, so yeah, he grew up in New York. He had an older brother, Jarvis, who was a very good athlete and a fabulous student. Just kind of the classical older brother who excels at everything and makes you feel totally inadequate every day of your life. And a lot of boys probably have that situation as teenagers, because the world of adolescence is just brutal. But Rockwell never really overcame the feelings of inadequacy that he experienced in his childhood. And as an artist, always felt like nothing was good enough. The work wasn't good enough. He was incredibly driven and hard on himself. And suffered really from feelings of loneliness. He suffered from depression. He had enormous anxiety. He was not somebody who derived a lot of pleasure from his work or from his life in this world. And in my book, of course, I go into great detail about his relationship with the great psychoanalyst Erik Erikson. He moved to Stockbridge, actually, in 1953 after he had begun treatment with Erikson. He always pretended that he moved because his wife was at Austin Riggs. Blame it on the wife. Everyone blames everything on the wife. He always said, oh, my wife had problems, so we moved there. But he himself had just entered therapy. I was so glad to find that letter at Austin Riggs that indicated that he actually began his treatment while he was still living in Arlington, Vermont, because it indicated to me how much he wanted to treat himself and how... Just how help me here. What's the phrase? How eager he was to find support. He moved to Stockbridge to be with Erikson. And it turned out to be the most constructive relationship of his life, as far as I'm concerned. I think Erikson really provided him with enormous support and reassurance. And Erikson had been an artist himself in his wandering youth. And some of their sessions were more like artist crits than like analysis, where Erikson would go over to his studio and they would sit and talk about a particular work, and Rockwell would say, I don't know, the tree branches don't fit on the painting. And Erikson would say, so make them smaller. I mean, you know, because I have some tapes, they're really interesting to listen to, in which Rockwell recounts the advice that Erickson gave him on a day-to-day basis. And I'm amazed at how much painting advice Erickson gave him and would just help him make up his mind about things that were hard to decide. And he was a generally indecisive person. It was hard to, I mean, a lot of us can understand that, that it was just hard to figure out what to do sometimes. And he liked having somebody really smart to ask, like Erik Erikson, who was, of course, a great genius. Some people think he was second only to Freud in terms of the originality and quality of his thinking. So, what time is it? Okay, so, what time is it?
5:08.
5:08. Should we move to questions, or should I give more background? More background? Well, that's nice. Okay, all right. So that was really a fascinating part of my research for me, trying to find out everything I could about Rockwell's relationship with Erik Erikson. And, you know, they socialized, too. There are photographs of them at this men's club that they both belonged to that would have lunch. They would have lunch on every Tuesday, this group of men. I don't know, this is like such a 50s thing. I can't relate. Like, what fun is that, you know? A group of men having lunch. Like, what were their wives doing, you know? Why did not bring the wives? Or were they not supposed to eat? The wives didn't get to eat out? I don't know. The whole thing strikes me as so dated. But Erickson and Rockwell, I have a picture in my book at one of the meetings of the Marching and Chatter Society, as they called it. And there were about 10 guys sitting at this table. And that also is very unconventional for a therapist to socialize at the Marching and Chatter Society with a patient of his. So Erickson treated Rockwell in a totally unconventional way, in a way that would not pass much muster today. But whatever he did seems to have worked, and I think it was a very constructive relationship. Have we discussed the Maxfield Parrish mural in the Curtis Building? It was funny, in Rockwell's time, you know, there was a fountain beneath it, and the water would bubble up from the fountain and go behind the mural and then drip down over it. It was like a wet mural, I swear to God. Because the fountain is still there, but there's no water in it. And I wondered today if that would ever be turned on again. It's great that it's still here. Someone told me today that Steve Wynn tried to buy it. And so who raised money to keep it here? How did that happen?
The city council.
Uh-huh, because Philadelphia is very good at that. They wouldn't let it leave, right. Philadelphia is really good. I mean, famously because of the Aikens painting that Philadelphia refused to let leave the city. I don't know if there are... I don't think there are too many Rockwells here. I don't think there are any in the Philadelphia Museum of Art. It's funny, museums did not really collect him during his lifetime, and now the paintings cost too much for them to collect. They can't afford to buy them. And it'll be very interesting. Okay, so the three major paintings that are coming up for auction tomorrow morning, I want you all to pay attention. Saying grace tomorrow what the results are and where these paintings go. And I'll be so upset if they leave the country. That could happen. Okay, for the past 18 years, they've been at the Rockwell Museum. So think how, you know, crushed the museum was when the Ken Stewart family, his three children, took the paintings out this past fall and said, we're selling them. And it'll be interesting. I don't know who can afford to buy a painting for $20 million in this country. There aren't too many people. I thought maybe Alice Walton. Why? Well, she has that museum, Crystal Bridges. Has anyone been there to Bentonville? And she, you know, has taken it upon herself to put together a collection of American art very belatedly, because, you know, things get expensive over time. So she does have Rockwell's Rosie the Riveter, That's in Arkansas. And I like to see his paintings distributed to other museums than the Rockwell Museum. As much as I love the Rockwell Museum, I think it's very well run and really succeeded in protecting his work all these years when no one was paying attention to it. I mean, who knows? Probably half of it would have been thrown away by now if it weren't for the museum. I do find it gratifying to see his paintings shown in general interest museums, and I, you know, I think they can hold their own next to Grant Wood and Thomas Hart Benton and the artists of his era. So, will Alice Walton buy that painting tomorrow? Okay, I'm predicting, when you hear the news, I'm saying no. I'm going to predict that George Lucas buys it, saying grace, because he's a big collector of illustration. He wants to open his own museum. And he's very focused on Rockwell. Alice Walton already has a Rockwell. So I don't think she's willing to go to 20 or 30 million for a second one. I'm predicting George Lucas. If it leaves the country, if it goes to Dubai, I'm going to cry. We don't have any paternity laws in this country. Other nations do. They don't really let what they consider to be their treasures leave the country, just like Philadelphia. I mean, you're such a model for the United States. You don't let your treasures leave. And the people really of this city fight to keep them here. But that's very unusual because, you know, we live in a capitalist culture, and we're all glad we do. And, you know, the people with the money get the paintings. That's just the way it goes. And I think Philadelphia is really unusual in the way it's come together for both the Maxfield Parish and the Aikens Anatomy Lesson. No, the Clinic of Dr. Gross. The Gross Clinic, right, to keep those paintings here. I mean, it's just, I'm so moved by that because it establishes that art plays a role in the lives of everybody in Philadelphia. I mean, that was a citywide decision that the people of Philadelphia made both times, right? To keep those works here? The Maxfield Parish and the Aikens, just those two. There are no other examples like that, are there? But that's incredible that that happened here twice. You never hear of that happening elsewhere. I don't know of any story like that in another city. Okay, so now we're going to take questions from our wonderful audience. Thank you for being so engaged. Okay, so do you want to speak into a microphone? How are we going to do this? So how about the man in the blue sweater? The microphone. Thank you. Okay.
The New York Times this morning.
Oh, no. I knew that was coming up.
Okay, then I don't have to say anything else.
Okay, yeah, the Times today, I don't know why they carried the piece, but they did carry a piece. Reporting on a statement from what they referred to as the Rockwell family, which was unhappy with my book. And the Rockwell family is pretty large and diverse. In this case, it is true that Rockwell's granddaughter, who I was very close to when I was working on this book and who I considered a dear friend, Abigail, if you look in my acknowledgments, I describe her as a radiant singer and a dear friend. I mean, we were really close. Like, she would come visit me a lot, and we would go for walks in the park. That she is very unhappy with the book. And she claims that I make him out to be gay. Okay? And I was really shocked when this letter was read to me yesterday by the New York Times. God, talk about bad phone calls. I was surprised because nowhere in the book do I say that Rockwell was gay. And I'm an art critic. I take that very seriously. I'm not a shrink, okay? I understand what the obligations of an art critic. And I feel like as a biographer, you can't be a psychiatrist because people are basically unknowable. I'm not interested in speculating about their sexuality. I lay out the evidence. You can lay out evidence about things that happened, but I don't draw any conclusions at all about his sexuality in the book. And I do say that the work showed homoerotic tendencies. I mean, he was an artist who always preferred painting men and boys to women. His His paintings, his affectionate portrayals of boys far outnumber those of women. And he himself often lamented that he didn't know how to paint a sexy woman and he didn't really know why. That doesn't make him gay, of course, by any stretch of the imagination, but the granddaughter thought that I was implying that. And so I'm sorry to see her hurt, that she's this wounded and lashing out. And that saddens me because I like the Rockwells a lot. It's a large family. There are three sons. I work very closely with two of them, and I certainly got along with everybody, the children, the grandchildren. They were delightful. So, you know, I don't want it to... It's sad for me for it to end this way, if it is, in fact, ending. On the other hand, I feel like the claim is just untrue, that the book does not say, it categorically says he is not gay, despite the fact that he loved painting male figures, which is somewhat unusual. It's not what was on most magazine covers. Most magazine covers of his era showed beautiful women and men in tuxedos. They were very aspirational. Think of the Roaring Twenties. No one was painting schoolboys frolicking with mutts. They were painting elegant New York City parties and the Jazz Age. And he really made that his specialty. And many stories of that period say that Rockwell paint... There's one headline from a story in the Boston Globe. It's in the book from 1923. Rockwell paints boys, not girls. Again, that's... Make of that what you will. Make of it what you will. Some people will say that there was more demand for boys. Some people will say he had more affection for boys and find the behavior troubling. I don't draw any of those conclusions. I just state what happened. The book is very carefully researched, 12 years of intense reporting. And, you know, in the sex part, or what she considers the sex part, takes up, you know, about four sentences. So for me to see all my research now ignored so that we can all discuss this burning non-issue is a terror. For me, that's the injustice. I feel like there are so many revelations in the book, such as no one ever knew that Andy Warhol collected Rockwell. He bought two paintings. He had one of Jackie and one of Santa. Which to him were the same person, just a big star, Jackie, Santa, those first name celebrities. You know, I found that artists really loved Rockwell. Willem de Kooning really liked his work. And okay, I mean, so I'm sorry to see the discussion focused on the question of sexuality, which is not what my book is about. And I'm only hoping that the family, which I really came to love over all these years, we had a lot of fun together. I'm only hoping that over time, the family will come to see that my book is not about sex, and it is about granting Rockwell his rightful place in American culture. In the meantime, there's nothing I can do about it. Yes.
On several subjects, on the sexuality, I think part of it was that was a male-dominated society. Who was writing for the Post? Jack London, Booth Tarkington, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Somerset Maugham, Hemington, Mark Twain. And who was painting for them? James Montgomery Flagg, Charles Dana Gibson, Howard Chandler Christie. These were all men that he idolized and was friendly with. So that may have been part of that. But to skip to another subject.
You're right. There were so many boys' stories in that era. So many stories of boys going camping in Canada.
Right.
It's amazing. And the magazines were filled with them. And I think, well, what were girls supposed to read? Were they supposed to just sit there and sew while the boys were off on their wilderness trips?
In addition, he was art editor for Boys Life magazine.
Right.
And he had three sons. So that part of it I can understand. And I haven't read the book, so I don't care about that. But on another subject, the permission business. I knew Rockwell very well. As a young boy, my brother and I saved the Saturday Evening Post covers. And in the early 70s, we met him, got very friendly with him. And I said, you know, nobody's ever done a book with every one of your covers in it. And he told me at that time, well, I can give you the rights. And I was in medicine. I mean, I never did any publishing, writing, other than little kids' books. Anyway, he said, I can give you the picture rights, but I can't give you the byline rights.
Mm.
And first you have to meet my lawyer, Arthur Abelman, in New York, and get the picture rights, which I did. And then my brother and I flew out to Indianapolis and met Corey and Bert Servaas, told them about we would like to write a book with every single Rockwell cover. And they said, fine, no payment whatsoever. We got permission. We did this three-volume set, sold 160,000 sets. Simon & Schuster published it.
What book is this?
It's called Norman Rockwell and the Saturday Evening Post.
That's fabulous.
And then I did another book called The Advertising World of Norman Rockwell. People didn't know he did commercial work for 120 companies. I got permission from everyone to use the ad in a book, and that was equally successful.
Well, I should have employed you when I was negotiating with the Post.
So there's a lot more to this.
It's very complicated.
I'm going to read your book, and I can't wait. But,
okay. I'll give you my address, and I'm going to take yours, because the next time I need images, I know who to go to.
I have them all. I have them all. I got an attic full.
Aren't we almost at the point where we can say, what's wrong with being gay? I mean, I'm really uncomfortable apologizing for that.
I agree.
Well, we're not quite there yet, but we're almost there. I mean, Cary Grant did sue for and win a lawsuit against someone who said he was gay.
But did you read the piece in the Times? Did you read the...
No, I haven't.
Oh, but I'm wondering, did you, like, yeah. No, I agree. A story like... It's ridiculous that we're covering this anyway in this day and age. I mean, whether someone, you know, like... It's just ridiculous that it's too late to be covering this. It's not considered a scandal being gay, you know? It's considered a legitimate choice. Or, I shouldn't use the word choice, right? It's considered a legitimate lifestyle. And everybody in this country understands that and should respect it.
The other thing I wanted to say was I believe there is still a huge Maxfield Parish out at George School, in, not George School, Westtown, a Quaker school outside of Philadelphia. It's in the lunchroom. And it's what it's called. It's a great huge sort of monster over a beach. It's as big as this wall.
How did it get to the lunchroom? Those lucky students who eat lunch with a Maxfield Parish. And here too in the library here, I see you have many original Wyatts. That's really nice. That's so great to have. I know you'll hold on to those. I mean, clearly no one gets art away from Philadelphia. Yes.
Did you have an opportunity in your research to interview and work with any of the models, many of the people who lived in the community? Because we have heard them lecture in the summer at the Rockwell Museum, and it's some of the most interesting lectures.
It is, yeah. Well, there were many, many models. You know, for one painting he often used, for one figure he often used many models. And his technique is just incredible to contemplate because he spent so much time and energy on rendering not just every face, but every object. I mean, if he had a piano in a painting, if there's a piano in the background, you could be sure that piano was in his studio and he was drawing from life. And if he was rendering a newspaper, he had the newspaper in his studio. I guess that's less interesting. But if he was drawing a chicken, he had the chicken in his studio. He really needed to work from life and was too humble to work from his imagination. Yes.
I grew up in that era, and I sold Saturday Evening Post in suburban Philadelphia as a boy. And my impression of the Curtis Publishing Company was it wasn't only the Saturday Evening Post. They had a fleet of magazines.
Right, Country Gentleman.
Country Gentleman, Boys Life.
Ladies Home Journal.
Ladies Home Journal. They had a fleet. And at some time in the 60s or 70s, they just did not keep those franchises going. They were just left go, and they just either there was a loss of interest in those subjects or they just went out of business. I will bet many Philadelphians don't even know the Curtis Building was the center of all that activity. It's been so long ago.
It's interesting that they were so powerful in America and have really just faded. But all magazines, as we know, now are facing hard times. And television, blame it all on TV. Well, I mean, now everything's online, and it's very expensive to print a magazine. And also, a magazine comes late compared to seeing news as it's unfolding on your computer. So, you know, the whole field is changing dramatically, and I assume that somehow we'll find a new form that is as exciting as magazines used to be. That's what I tell my sons. I say, it's up to you. Could you please figure it out? Because, you know, everyone says they haven't found the new business model so that newspapers and magazines could make money online. And it's like, why not? Someone's going to find it. So that's something you could all work on when you go home tonight. We need to find the new lucrative model for newspapers and magazines. The problem is, of course, that people, advertisers, don't like advertising online because nobody clicks on the ads. When you click on an ad, you always feel like you'll never get back to the original story. It's probably a virus. It's, you know, it'll lead to some airplane ad. I don't know. It always seems to take you somewhere else and make it hard to get back. And so what's interesting, okay, the Post was the first magazine in the country. This is really interesting to me. To earn its revenue, not from subscriptions mainly, but from advertising. That was its great realization, that you could sell the magazine for less than it cost to produce. So it really dropped its cover price. The cover price was a nickel, which was less than all most other magazines were then, 35 cents or a quarter. And it that way it jacked up its circulation, right? Everyone could afford to buy it. And they made their money from advertising instead of making it from circulation. And, you know, if you look at the old 19th century magazines, there are very few ads in them. They supported themselves through subscriptions. And the Post's model became the model of the 20th century. The, you know, when magazines were thriving, they tried to keep the cover price low so they could increase their circulation and therefore attract a lot of advertising. And that is precisely the model that has collapsed now in the age of the internet because there's no more advertising revenue. Okay? Advertisers don't want to spend a lot of money advertising online. And so newspapers have gone back to depending on subscribers. Like, you know, the Times is now trying to get a lot of subscribers. And they're putting their stories behind paywalls. You know all this. Newspapers, is the Inquirer, it's not behind a paywall, is it? Can you read the Inquirer every day if you don't subscribe? You have to subscribe. Wow. That he's lonely and complicated? You have to read the book. You have to read the book. But he was somebody, he didn't like to be alone. He was kind of afraid to be alone. He always had to have people around. And he, I mean, I interview one psychiatrist who lived in the house with him for a few years, who later became the head of counseling at Columbia University for 30 years. His name is Anthony Phillip. And he moved into Rockwell's house, and they would talk nightly. And he said Rockwell was a very shaky presence who just worried about everything. He just had all kinds of fears, and he needed to be reassured. But I was really glad actually that I encountered. I said, "What did Rockwell talk about? Like, what did you talk about every night?" He said, "Well, mostly, you know." He said he talked about the painting he was working on, and he was worried that he wasn't going to get it right. He would worry a lot about his paintings for the Post. And also, he said he worried a lot about his health, that he was a hypochondriac who would talk about how he wasn't feeling well, and he went to the doctor and, you know, had a lot of ailments. It's not particularly sexy stuff, what he talked about with Dr. Philip, but I did get the impression from him and many others that Rockwell was beset with anxieties, both rational and irrational. Okay.
Two quick questions. You mentioned there are three paintings being sold tomorrow. You mentioned one. I was curious what the other two were. Mm-hmm. And then the other question is, you said earlier that the art community and art collectors, probably more the art community, look down on illustrators. Rockwell seems to have broken out of that a bit. But this area happens to be very rich in a lot of illustrators, whether it be Pyle, N.C. Wyeth, Schoonover, and so forth. Do you think in time some of those artists will be recognized
as artists?
Yes,
it's rising. They're rising. Because when one rises, he pulls up the others. And I think, you know, as much as I bemoan the art market and the way it distorts the way we look at art, because I'm an art critic and I try to stay pure and ignore the value, the financial value attached to paintings. It's no way to look at a work of art, right? I do think that the sale of the Rockwells will create a lot of interest in other illustrators, because that's one part of the market that is not as inflated as other parts. You know, you can no longer afford to buy a Jasper Johns, but is there millions of dollars? You can't afford to buy a Warhol, but last night I did go to the preview at Sotheby's. I never go to the auction houses, but I wanted to see the Rockwell, so I went to look at a preview that Sotheby's was holding, and they post the price next to every painting on the wall, the price that they expected to go for, and I was amazed at how affordable the Maxfield Parrishes seemed. Like, the Rockwells are off the charts, you know. Very few people can afford to spend $20 million on a painting, but there were beautiful Maxfield Parrishes for $200,000, which at the time, when you're standing there in that building, seems reasonable, because that's how distorting being there is. You start thinking, well, you know, okay, I can't afford a $20 million painting, but $200,000, well, that's a good deal. Now, they're much, much less, and I do think that they will go up. It's funny, I just found a first edition Howard Pyle book at the Strand. It's his book of pirates, okay? It was like published in 1901 or two. It's a big, gorgeous picture book, and it was $10. And I thought, yeah, this market has to, I would think, has to rise a bit. And I would like to see American illustration looked at more seriously by the art historical community. Oh, the other two paintings. Ugh, I never answer a question. Okay, so Saying Grace, you know, that's right. The old lady and the little boy at the train station is a bunch of kind of young guys look on with amazement. And then there's The Gossips, which is on the cover of my book. And I was so horrified. I couldn't believe it, you know, because my editors picked this painting to put on the cover. And after the book had gone to press, in the fall, that painting was pulled out of the Rockwell Museum and put up for sale at Sotheby's. And I didn't want to contribute to the promotion of the sale. But I thought, it's funny, as hard as I try to stay pure, you know, you can't escape the market. So there I am with this painting that's coming up for sale tomorrow on the cover of my book. I would have preferred to have a painting that's in the Rockwell Museum. I had no idea that the painting was about to be yanked out of the museum and sold. So that made me, I don't know, there seemed to be a moral in there somewhere. And the third painting is Walking to Church, which a lot of people like. It kind of looks like a Dutch realist painting. There's a beautiful brick buildings on a street and a family walking along. The one that will bring the highest is surely Saying Grace, and I think The Gossips will go for much more than they're predicting. They're predicting $8 million. So tomorrow, look for it. I know. It's insane. And maybe somebody will buy them and donate them to the Rockwell Museum. What are the chances of that? Zero, right. Yes.
Who are they?
Howard Pyle, I would say, and J.C. Leindecker. in terms of illustrators, but he loved illustration. He really saw that as his family, and he bought the work of other illustrators, which is really, I think that's very touching. He really saw that as his family. It's what he identified with. American and European illustration. And those works that he collected are now owned by the Rockwell Museum. And then he drew very heavily from art history. A lot of his paintings riff on masterpieces. Most famously, Rosie the Riveter, which is based on the figure of Isaiah as painted by Michelangelo on the Sistine ceiling, and many others. I mean, you know, there's a famous painting from 1928 of the pediatrician listening to the doll's heartbeat. And that painting is a real leap forward for Rockwell compared to what he was doing. That painting, you know, I was looking and looking, thinking, how did he, it's such a great painting. What drove him forward? And I realized he had just come back from Europe. And if you look at the details at that painting, if you look at what's hanging in the doctor's office, there are reproductions of Rembrandt's. And then I thought, that painting is his riff on the anatomy lesson. He's doing a kind of populist version about... but anyway, there's a lot of references to Dutch painting in that one particular painting. And many of his works kind of pay either very overt or covert homage to European masterpieces. We're going to end it here. Thank you all for coming and asking such good questions. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.